Welcome, and thank you for joining me on the Listen by Heart podcast. I'm your host, Jasmine Lowe. The origins of this podcast can be traced back to a project titled Listen to Your Heart, a TEDx talk I gave at the Multimedia University in Cyberjaya, also known as TEDxMMU. And the initial idea was a deep dive into frequencies and vibrational healing, something I was very passionate about as my mother had just survived a non-malignant brain tumor operation, and a part of her healing process involved speaking about what she would remember. One of the first things she said to me was, "Jasmine, go downstairs and buy a coconut for me." Mom chatted to me about her life as a schoolgirl, a teacher, and it was a great way for her to talk about her life. It also became a storytelling session where I started to understand who I was. Welcome to season 6 of the Listen by Heart podcast, where we feature stories from women of the South China Sea. I'm your host, Jasmine Lowe, and on this audio journey, we welcome Su Lin Tan. I first met her in Sydney when she had just left her post at the Australian Financial Review, and she's now with the South China Morning Post. She has 25 years of business experience, is a qualified accountant, and was once an investment banker and analyst. As a journalist, Su Lin reports on business and financial news, housing and commercial property, street talk and investigations, as well as trade and conflicts, and the macroeconomy. So, hi, Su Lin, how are you?
Hi, great. Good, how are you?
I'm good. You're back in Sydney?
At the moment, yes, yes.
And you were actually having a little stint outside of Australia.
Yes, I did. I left Australia at the start of the pandemic, which was one of the worst times to be overseas. And I've been there since early 2020. I've been overseas since early 2020, and it's been 3 years. So, yeah. A long time.
So were you in lockdown situations by any chance?
It was Hong Kong. I was in Hong Kong, and Hong Kong was tricky, very tricky. We didn't have lockdowns per se, but definitely there were a lot of curfews and restrictions, you know, over five or six rounds. So, you know, it was quite difficult having a normal life. But again, we're all in the same boat globally. So, yeah.
And you headed back to Australia earlier this year?
So, yes, I did. I left Hong Kong and then I moved to Singapore because it was time to go, I guess, after being trapped there for over two years. And, yeah, and then I'm just currently back on a small break to see friends and family. So, yeah, but I'll be back in Singapore. That's where I am at the moment.
I mean, Australia always likes to think that it's, you know, at the heart of Asia Pacific. Mm. I remember going to university and those words, Australasia, came into my vocab. you've been, you know, you've pretty much spent half your life in Australia and probably quite a lot of it outside of Australia. Mm. Do you have anything to share on this?
I on the other hand, don't think that Australia thinks it's at the center of Asia Pacific. I think it likes to own a bit of that identity, but I think for the longest time, as far as I have been in Australia, I feel that it never was and never really is at the moment part of that, you know, well, it is Asia Pacific geographically, but it's not in Asia, if that makes any sense. So is it at the center? No, it's kind of at the bottom of the region, really. So geographically, it's not at the center. So, yeah, I think it's at the fringes of the region, really. And I think it has a lot to do to get into the center of the region, personally speaking. But of course, people have different views about that.
I like to say Australia is on the south side of the South China Sea.
Yes, it is. It certainly is on the south side. Centre, not quite. So, yeah, I and now being outside of Australia, I realise actually how it is Asia Pacific because it is in the region, but it is not quite in the centre of it. The other countries that are in Asia Pacific are very much at the centre of it. Southeast Asia, for example, or the ASEAN countries, they're very much at the centre of it, and there's so much activity there that isn't similar to Australia. In fact, very different. The rest of Asia Pacific is very different to Australia or Australasia, being, you know, Australia, New Zealand, and the Pacific Islands. So, yeah, I guess how do we define Asia Pacific? I think that's a very tricky one. Certainly, there are two worlds at play here.
I think when you look at a lot of multinationals, a lot of them do say that their Asia Pacific or regional headquarters for Asia are based in Australia. Mm. And I always find that really fascinating from an economics gateway point of view.
Yeah. I think Australians need to realize that Asia Pacific is a lot larger than just Australia, if that makes any sense. There's almost a certain sort of oblivion here when, you know, Australians think that they are at the center of the region, because that's not quite true. The rest of Asia is extraordinarily large and extraordinarily varied and diverse. And the thing is, the center of the world and the real headquarters of the world are actually in Asia. And for that matter, that can be, we're talking about Asia Pacific. It really is sort of, you know, from South Korea, Taiwan, I suppose you could say that's North Asia, but the Indochina area, Southeast Asia, and then stretching down to Australia. But really, that region in the center, the Southeast Asian region, that I feel, you know, is the heart of Asia Pacific. Mainly, the population's there. So that is where the activity is. And then the economic and social cultural vibrance is there as well. So and all of them are locked in together because they're so close to each other. So that really is like the beating heart of Asia Pacific. But then again, you know, some people would disagree with me, I'm sure.
Well, Sulin, you were based in Hong Kong, which is a former, an emancipated island that has now been returned to China contentiously in 1999. Mm-hmm. I still remember it very well because I was just at university, and I think it could be the case for you as well. You were in university around that time in the 90s?
Yes, I was, yeah.
And very vivid images of China during that time would be the Tiananmen Square massacre. Mm. I was wondering what life was like for you as a university student in Australia.
Yeah, look, it was a very extraordinary experience. And I came here as a teen, and then I went to school and I went to university. Because these years were the earlier years of my time in Australia. They were very very raw, I suppose. Firstly, it's an Anglo-Saxon country, so it's very different to Asia or Malaysia, where I was born, and Singapore, where I schooled. So there was a lot of adjustment to the language. You know, we speak English, but we don't really speak the same English. There's also, you know, cultural differences, attitudes, and also racism, I suppose. At the time in the 90s, I think racism is used very loosely, but more ignorance, a knowledge about, you know, Asian immigrants at the time. And of course, you know, in the 80s and 90s, when they when it all first started, you know, it was all still very new. You know, the Vietnamese boat people had just arrived, and then there was an influx of Malaysians and Singaporeans. And so it was a very raw time because it was lonely because, you know, the life that you knew isn't there. And it's a lot less dense in Australia compared to Malaysia and Singapore. So it feels very sparse and, you know, you're not connected with the world.
Did that give you the room to grow as a writer? Because you were internalizing a lot of things at that time, possibly? Could that be?
You know, I always say as a journal, I don't have a novel in me. I don't want to write anything, you know, in long form, as in, so I don't have a book to write. But I think it gives me, it gave me a sense of storytelling. It gave me a sense of an ability to tell stories, and stories not just any story, but stories that are about the truth and facts and unknown, you know, pieces of information. Because there's so much about Australian immigrants that people don't know, and I think that does give me this that want to tell what really is.
I find it really funny, actually, this year in particular, when we were celebrating Australia Day. I thought about Sorry Day, of course.
Yes.
And also about the fact that Australia is still under the crown.
Yes, yes.
And as a Southeast Asian from a country that was declaring its freedom in 1957,
yes,
and from that region where you have, in that same month in August, Singapore, Malaysia, and Indonesia celebrating Independence Days.
Yeah.
And yet,
yeah,
in Australia, there's no such thing. I found that so farcical.
Yeah. I think, yeah, it's so funny. It's so ironic. I was just talking to my partner about that just yesterday. We were just thinking about Australia Day and thinking, what is Australia Day? I mean, and why are we celebrating Australia Day? Because as you said, in other countries, their national day celebrates a moment in history, a very poignant moment of independence and self-establishment, a real declaration of independence. Whereas Australia Day is what? The first day that Westerners came to Australia? I don't really, you know what I mean? Like, it's, I don't think that's a day I want to celebrate as I would call Australia Day, the first day that Anglo-Saxons stepped on the shores of Australia. I mean, it doesn't really mean anything. Is it discovered then? No, because the Aboriginals have been here for thousands of years. So is it discovered? No. Is it independent? No. Is it separated from someone else? Not really. So you're right. It is quite a bizarre day to actually call Australia Day.
I really hope as a new migrant, I mean, I'm not a new migrant. I can't even consider myself as a migrant. I just feel like I'm a transient being in Australia. And I've watched it from the 80s, celebrating its bicentennial, 200 years of, you know, I can't even imagine how it would be for someone of First Nations to think about that day. And as an Asian, or what they call as immigrant, or as a Southeast Asian, wherever we go, I don't belong anyway. Because everyone's trying to tell me to go back to China, but I don't belong there either. I was just wondering if you feel this predicament.
Always, all the time. I even started to pretend I'm from other countries when people ask me where I'm from in Australia. You know, I go to a pub and they say, "Are you from Thailand?" I said, "No, why would I be from Thailand? Or where are you from?" The "where are you from" question really bothers me a lot. You know, the first instinct is to look at a person and go, "You must be foreign. You must be another kind of person. You are the others." That, and as long as you're not blonde or white, then you're not Australian. That is quite remarkable, given that we're an immigrant country. And it's such a complex problem for all of us. And that's why if you're not assumed to be a person from that place, you started, as you said, you start developing these sort of transient feelings, and you become quite loose, and you become not really as though you're part of this place when you truly are. Your passport says that. And so you start to wonder where you really belong. And that can be a very big problem for the social fabric of Australia. If it wants its people to be together, it needs to, from the top, really empower people to really accept everybody as Australians. Assume them first as Australians, and then as, you know, conversation and develops to explore their background and so on and so forth. You know, you don't go up to an Anglo-Saxon person in Australia and go, oh, sorry, where are you from? Scotland? You don't really do that. So that's farcical, actually, in my mind. And it still is the case after so many years of immigration. It's almost it's stuck in time, doesn't really understand its immigrant identity or position. And for that matter, you know, as an immigrant, I really would have liked to have, you know, I was telling my partner yesterday that I really would have liked to be more knowledgeable about Aboriginal stories. I really like to receive my citizenship from an Aboriginal leader, for example. I would have liked to have learned more about Indigenous history and, you know, the dreaming and all those things that are actually very Australian. And that really isn't the case. And that, I think, would have been a great way to identify Australia and for them to welcome all its immigrants as Australians, first and foremost, and nothing else. So you're right. I think it's a bit of a problem, but I don't know if, you know, all Australians see it that way. Certainly for me as an immigrant, I share your feelings.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And I think it's a great idea, what you just proposed.
I certainly feel that way strongly, and more so now as I get older. I'm starting to read more about Aboriginal stories and try and, you know, understand the land that I'm on, you know, what that all means. It's really hard because, you know, I was telling my partner too, you know, streets in Australia need to have the names of the streets and then the land where they're on, so that people are fully exposed to the idea that we're on Aboriginal land and we know what Aboriginal land we're on. We need to be able to identify where the elders are, and on Australia Day, we should be able to go and learn these things. There should be more of that, more exposed, more public. Yeah, even more positively, you know, to really learn its history and be so in your face about it. It's like we're so in the face about beaches and pubs. Why couldn't we be more in your face about Aboriginal stories and history and knowledge and cultures? So
if it takes immigrants in Parliament to do this, let's make it happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've got representation now.
You know, it's really remarkable that it's 2020. Well, it was 2022 last year when the election happened, but that was when they were starting to celebrate more diverse representation in Parliament. I find that remarkable that a country, an immigrant country, is for the first time saying, oh my God, look at this representation. It's the best we've ever had. I'm thinking, what? That is sorry. That is a big sorry, actually.
You know, Celine, we haven't got that in the media, and you are one of our, how would you say, guiding lights?
Yeah. I wouldn't say to a lot of people I'm not. I'll be honest, I'm an outsider. You know, it's like a club. There is a central narrative and there are journos who are part of that narrative. They're in that club. They all believe the same things. You know, a lot of them aren't, this is not a criticism, but, you know, a lot of them, you know, they're not data or evidence driven. They're very much straight out of J school, and they belong to that club, and that's okay. But everyone else who thinks differently or behaves differently or does their journalism differently are considered outside. So it's a very difficult place to be on your own. And you're fighting a very tough battle when you try and do stories that are different, because like everything else, journalism, well, you can talk about it being independent. Oh, it's great, tells the truth and seeks justice. But a lot of it's very political as well. So it's tough being an Australian journalist who has a different way of doing things. You know, it's very different. If you're not fully Aussie and you believe the same things or same political vibes, etc., then it can be a bit challenging.
What's your earliest memory as a child?
I think it was, as a kindergarten student, I suppose, as a kid, I think that was my earliest in actually in Johor Bahru in Malaysia. I remember being at school and waiting for my mom to pick me up. And it was one of those schools that was next to a convent. In those days, it was still very much, you know, you still see the sisters in the convent. And that was my earliest memory. I remember wearing this little pinafore, this little check pinafore. I was running around. It was very exciting at the time. Everything was very innocent and very pure.
What type of school was it?
I think it was a private kindergarten. I think you could say it's private. And it was all kinds of different kids in there. It was called the Hilltop Kindergarten. It doesn't exist anymore. And there were a lot of teachers, local teachers, and some foreign teachers, I suppose. And then you got kids from all walks of life. And, you know, there were Malaysian Indians, Malaysian Malays, Malaysian Chinese. And it was just, it was really quite extraordinary.
Did you have nuns as teachers?
No. Hilltop was the kindergarten. Didn't have as nuns, but when I went to primary school the next year, yes, I had nuns as teachers. Primary school in convent, primary school in Johor Bahru, it's still there. There are no more nuns. They've left. Now it's a national school, so it's very different now. But then they had chapels, and you had to go upstairs to, you know, do a prayer if you like to. You can talk to the sisters, and they were very lovely. And they were teachers, and they were mentors and counselors. And the halls of the convent felt like, you know, a bit of a nunnery, I think, in a way. And it was very, very, very sweet, very lovely.
I must say that I'm currently sitting in Penang, and on my feet are tiles that are made in Scotland.
Oh, really?
It's quite amazing when you think about it. This building was built in 1938.
Wow.
And somehow these tiles made its way all the way from Scotland. Mm. I'm always in awe. And I think the Scotsmen, their clans, and the Chinamen and their clans, there must be some kind of link.
Oh, look, we're so similar. It's not funny, actually. It really is. I mean, we can talk about the East and the West, but really when it comes down to, you know, tribes and collectiveness and all that, it's very similar. The same thing in Malaysia. There's so many clans and different groups of people with their identity and their practices. And that's where the similarity is. And also, as you were saying, that you get these Scottish tiles. But, you know, Malaysia is like a big melting pot of everything. You've got all the British influence, you've got the local influences, you've got the Hokkien, the Cantonese, Malay, Chinese, everything, you know, it's just all mixed in there. But the thing is, it's so dense. There's just so many layers, like I'm sure you understand being in Penang, that, you know, some, you know, people speak Hokkien there, but in the center people speak Cantonese. And then for the south, we speak Hokkien again, but the Hokkien is different to the ones in the north. And then the people who have arrived on the shores of Penang would be very different from the people who arrived on the shores of Johor, for example. Mm. And their experience of the British rule would also be very different. I think in Penang, they're probably more sophisticated, perhaps. But the south, it's a bit different. And then the relics and the remnants and what's left behind in these places were all also very different. Some of them, I think in Johor, most of them is destroyed now. But I think in the north, it's still very well kept, as you can see under your feet. And similarly, like in Malacca and in places where there are other influences that's not British, like the Portuguese influence, my word, there are still places when you can see that still standing. Such an extraordinary, you know, melting pot, I think.
So, Lin Lui, how come Hokkien Wabo?
Sisters,
brothers, ubo?
Bo wa lao pe lo. 我甲我老爸老母讲了，顶摆咯，伊有伫我甲伊家讲话，甲我阿嬷讲咯，讲啊福建话，是啊。
Louis, I'm asking from which part of China?
诶，我阿嬷是福建人啦，所以伊是福建 province 哦。特别多了，我毋知啦。我想讲是厦门啊，什么地方我毋知。有人讲我卡森甲我讲是泉州啊，我不毋知。特别伊人多了是福建人啦。我的 grandfather，grandfather 的 father 啦，great grandfather 都是福建人咯，嗯，福建人。
See, when you speak like that, it just feels like home.
Oh no, really? Yeah, I mean, but it's a different Hokkien. Yours is softer. Mine is a lot harder, sharper.
But my paternal grandma speaks like that.
Does she really?
Yeah.
Oh wow. My paternal grandmother definitely speaks like that. Yeah.
So my paternal grandma, I think, is from Anhui or something like that.
Oh really? Anhui, wow.
Can
Yeah,
do
I
you know where
yeah.
your side's from, or have you
Well,
visited?
no, I understand it to be Fujian province. Certainly, I think it's on the water. So, Quanzhou or Xiamen, I don't know. Probably, I haven't been able to trace it back. My cousins tell me that they reckon it's Quanzhou, but I'm not too sure. So,
So if I were to ask you to go back to China, would you know where you could go back to?
not at all. Not even the slices, not even a fraction. No idea. Is as foreign to me as Scotland is, for example. Really is. No clue. No sense. And I'll be completely lost. I'll be and they'll probably glare at me and going, ah, foreigners here. So no idea.
Once, about 3 years ago, I was in Shenzhen. I must say, I've never felt more at home. Looks wise, right?
Well, it's certainly very modern now. It's incredibly welcoming, Shenzhen. It's got that proximity to Hong Kong, so it's super modern and super open to expats and foreigners. So yeah, it is pretty cool, I have to say. Yeah.
So, just to establish that, motherland, or would you even call it motherland? For your mother on the maternal side?
No, I actually don't see China as the motherland. Malaysia is the motherland. That's where I was born, and that's where my parents are from, I guess. But I suppose, no, I think what you're saying is motherland, the land of origins. It is the origins of my ancestors, I suppose. So both parents are from there, and as far as I know. And so, but it's kind of confusing because it's not. It's very hard for me to say that's the motherland because none of my parents are from there originally. I mean, they were born in Malaysia, and I don't know anybody from there because they've passed. They're long dead before I was even born. So yeah, so it's a bit weird, strange.
May I ask the names of your family?
So as in my
Your
parents,
mom. Your mom, your dad.
My dad, Dick Singh, my mom, Siu Lee. So
And
yeah,
what was Siu Lee like?
Siu Lee, she's I look a lot like her. So she was a very quiet person. She's fairly introverted, I think. She's not an extrovert. She's a lady, I suppose. She raised four children. She was a housewife for most of her life, after getting married. I think that's pretty standard for a lot of Malaysian women. Well, not now, back then. I think, my mother was an excellent cook. Oh, she could cook. She was a chef. She could bake. She used to make those duo bao, da bao, big,
Oh,
big sort of
there's
huge
huge
meat
ones.
buns. Yeah, absolutely. Huge meat buns, and then she'll make those by hand. She was an excellent tailor. She made all our clothes. She made a lot of our clothes, rather. Those the old Singer sewing machines. She would step on the thing and make them, and to give us all clothes. And it was quite interesting. Yeah, in those days, people were still making clothes.
So, mum was Sue Lee, and what was her surname?
Ho.
H-O, Ho?
Yes.
Oh, just like that famous comedian in Sydney now.
There is a famous comedian in Sydney with a surname Ho.
You have to Google or Instagram her.
Oh wow. Okay, let me check it out. Definitely. I feel apologetic that I didn't know. Yes.
Oh, must, you must, you must. It's He Huang Ho.
Oh, is she from
She's
the
originally
region?
from China.
Ah, right. I have to check her out. Yes.
I'll
So
share the link with you.
yeah, so
She's
Ho is,
amazing.
yes, absolutely. So Ho is her, I believe,
Yes.
as is my Tan is Chen. So yeah, so my mother was He Xiu Li or
So
Xiu Li.
Chen, He Xiu Li. Okay.
Yes, definitely.
And would you still keep in touch with her side of the family now?
Unfortunately, no. My mom passed when I was young, and so a lot of that family connection sort of a bit weakened since then. So yeah, no, I don't actually, which is quite sad.
Do you know who they are?
Yeah, you know what? When I was a lot younger, like a little girl, I've met them all. Like there was definitely two sisters, in Johor at the time. There were her parents who lived in Batu Pahat in Johor, and then and also her brothers. There were definitely her brothers, but they're all spread across Malaysia. I don't even know where they are now, to be honest. Yeah, I've met them. I've seen them, and I've had contact with them. I just, I haven't seen her after my teens, really, after she passed. So yeah, it's
That
a bit
must have
sad.
been a difficult time.
It was a difficult time. I think it's very hard losing your mother when you're young or you as a teenager. And it's hard to really share the experiences of people who have mums all their lives, who taught them how to pass down their cooking skills or teach them how to date or, share their birthing experiences and all those things. I don't really have that. I don't quite understand what it is to have a mom in that department. So yeah, it's very strange. Yeah.
I would like to sort of expand on that about the women who came before me. So, meaning the women who shaped me as I went. So, you had your mother until your teenage life. Was there another mother figure, or was she always there with you?
Yeah, look, there was my grandmother, Ama, who was she shaped a lot of my life. Yeah.
What was Amma's name?
This is a gig up, your gig up. Yeah, that's the name. She was born in the 1920s in Malaysia, gig up, and she was a typical Malaysian Ama. She was a She dotes on you, she'll cook for you, she'll fuss around you, she'll tell you folklores and mythologies, and she'll tell you about those days when she was young and, when she was in the jungle on the farm, and she'll tell you those stories, and she'll tell you about, oh, the Japanese occupation and how it was a terrible time. And yeah, she'll tell you all these little stories, and she'll have these old, old lady powder that she keeps in her handbag, and then she'll carry them around when she travels. She was in my life and formed a part of my life, because she gave me those stories that she formed a part of my heritage, because she gave me an insight into the 20s, 30s and 40s in Malaysia, and it gave me a sense of where I've sort of have come from, or the history of my family then. So yeah, so she gave me some insights, and also so the she's also a fairly doting person, so she'll fuss and all that, so she it gave me it taught me how to be a bit more doting, I suppose, nurturing in that sense, to care for a young person, to care for them, to give them food, to buy them a little glede or kue pisang or pisang, you know, goreng pisang, or you should come when she visits, she'll buy these little plastic bags of Malay kue, you know, to come and visit, you know, or you know, that kind of thing. So for me as a girl, you know, the gift of food is a sign of, you know, a love and care, you know. So for me, food is important. If I'm feeding somebody, I care for them. So I think that forms a large part of my life as a girl. Yes. So that's one person. And there are other aunties and I say aunties and uncles, but aunties along the way, you know, neighbors, aunties from other friends. And as even in Australia, there are Malaysian aunties and uncles, of mothers of other friends who have sort of adopted, you know, as part of, as like my mom, my pseudo mom, because they kind of remind me of those mom, the mom and my mom and grandmother at the time. And so it's a comfort zone. It's a comfort thing. So it's a comfort blanket to have those people around you. Yeah. So over the years, there have been a myriad aunties and people around me have, for, you know, been part of my life as a girl, as a woman.
And here we're talking about aunties that have no relation, no blood relation.
No relation, yeah. Any aunties, any Malaysian Singapore aunties are your aunties. You know, if you have a connection, they're your mom. That kind of thing.
So, yeah, I guess you're right. So Singapore, Malaysia would be motherland, not China.
Yeah, no. It's remarkable how people look at you and go, oh, you're Chinese. So, oh, you must be from China. And then all the political issues will start coming out. But no, I have no inkling of China whatsoever. All I know is ancestrally, I'm from there. That's it.
And, you know, one of the reasons why we're doing this podcast is because I had this idea to talk to 99 women and that we would each be sentinels of peace for the region.
Mm. Yes.
So we come from stock that from countries surrounding the South China Sea, nowhere else that we want peace more than in South China Sea. I mean, it's currently 11 countries, I believe, that are surrounding this area where there's an enormous amount of oil and gas deposits. So something like 4 trillion.
Yes, a lot of wealth, a lot of resources, correct.
Would you have anything to share about this area and what's going on?
Yeah, there's a lot of disturbances of late, obviously, as you know, with, you know, China advancing its interest in the area. And it's causing a lot of mayhem for everybody, you know, and of course, a lot of it's political. Why is it causing mayhem? Because other people have interests there. And when two interests collide, it becomes, you know, it becomes a conflict. And there are also interests of countries that are not from that region, for example, the US, and that causes more conflict. And so I think, yeah, so I think it's about growing powers. I mean, China is a growing power. There's no doubt about that. And when powers grow, they want to advance and expand their interests and what they own and what they have. And that's very natural. And so I think that's what's happening in the region. So it's like welcoming? It's like a new kid on the block. Then the new kid comes to school and everyone's like, oh, who's this? And they're disturbing, you know, the model, the system, the setup of the place. And that's what's happening around there. And all countries are cognizant of what's going on at the moment, especially the ones that are surrounding them. So, you know, the Asian countries, ASEAN in particular, because ASEAN will form a large part of those 11 countries. And yeah, so they're all very cognizant of what's going on. And I think every country has a different way of dealing with it, with what's happening.
I went on Google Maps and zoomed into Spratly Islands.
Yes.
It's quite interesting what you can find.
Indeed. What? There's so many islands out there. You, for the first time, you realize, oh my word, South China Sea is just thousands and thousands of islands. And you wouldn't even know what these Spratly Islands are about. My word. You know, in Singapore, I went to Bintan recently. Bintan's like an hour ride from Singapore, and that's Indonesia. So you know, it's very easy to pop from one island to another, and you're actually popping from one country to another. So yeah, tons of island.
Actually, in the region, when you look at Indonesia, it's huge.
Oh
I mean,
my God.
it's fast spreading.
Indonesia has the most islands in the region, and then there's the Philippines after that. I mean, together they have, you know, I think close to 20,000, I think, islands in the region. That's a lot of islands. So Spratly Islands, the few scattered around there, that's the center of this conflict. What are they again? Sorry, what's the fuss about? You know, so yes, certainly. It does surprise a lot of us.
What do you think is like the best way forward? I mean, from your point of view, as a journalist who's been based in Hong Kong, seeing what things are going on, as a journalist who also has her foot very steadily in Australia, what do you think is the best way forward?
If I say compromise, I don't know if that's going to go down well for a lot of people. But I think ultimately in all relationships, it's about compromising. And it's about agreeing to have different things. It's about sharing. That's going to be very difficult for, you know, political reasons, because, you know, that doesn't work. Sharing and compromise rarely works, I think. I mean, they have in the past over treaties and, you know, when things become better, peacetime. But I think you have to compromise. You have to accept that there are different powers in the region now. You have to first accept that things have changed, and it's no longer the Asia Pacific of yesteryears. The powers that are there at the moment. And when I say the powers, mainly the US, because it's the biggest power in the region. And I think it needs to, I think there needs to be a sense of, right, you're different, but we don't like that you're different. But how can we work with that difference is the key. Working with the difference is, I think, something politicians need to really understand and try to actually come to terms with it. Coming to terms is key, I think, because there's a lot of non-acceptance of the rise of China, that people think that China shouldn't rise and it has no right to rise. It's a human rights abuser. There's no place in this world. And I think that non-acceptance makes it very hard to move forward. When you accept that, then you can find ways to get around it and maybe work together. And by working together means you decide, if you are arguing over a piece of land, you decide how you're going to split that up. If you want naval bases, you agree all together, and, you know, both work, whichever the powers are there, to agree to have where and how. And they also have to, most importantly, work with all the other countries in the region, the physical countries there. For example, China is far north South China Sea, right? So, and the US is not even in the South China Sea. And then there's a lot of the other countries that you need to talk to, like Vietnam and all these other Philippines, countries that are actually in the region. And you have to work out a way to accept the fact and then split it up, or, you know, meet in the middle, compromise somehow or other. It sounds really simple, but isn't. I'm being very, very general about it. That's how I
focus. Do you focus a lot of your journalistic life on this topic?
Yeah, unfortunately, because to write about economics and trade, you'll have to talk about the geopolitics, unfortunately. Yes. So there's always a mention of that. So if there's a tension in trade or tension in business between countries, it's always a geopolitical reason why they're upset, why they're angry, why they're fighting, that kind of thing. So yes, it's always it's front and center of everything, but I don't report on the Spratly Islands specifically, or the defense around it, or the arms and all the ownership. You know, that's not really my thing, but certainly it does come up.
Are you working on anything in particular right now?
Not at the moment, no, because I'm taking a little break.
Okay. And what do you do when you're on a break?
Not read the news. Yeah. The news can be stressful, very stressful. Not read the news. I'm a beach bum. I'm a huge beach person. I swim. I enjoy the sun. I really do like that. And certainly I see my friends. I have a glass of wine. I do. I'm a big wine drinker. That's terrible. Everyone knows that.
Aussie
Yeah. Oh, any wine for that matter, anything that's
wine.
good. Sorry, but I think the wine thing is definitely very Aussie. That's the Aussie route. But I drink any other kinds of wine. But certainly when I'm back home in Sydney, it's nice to drink local wines. And especially in summer now, you drink wine, you sit by the beach, and you enjoy the aesthetic beauty of Australia. I think that's one of the nicest things about being home.
So Lynn, if I were to throw a stone at you suddenly and surprise you and say, "Hey, so Lynn, where are you from, mate?"
Well, I'll say I'm from Sydney.
Okay.
Sydney. That's what I'll say. Yeah. It depends on the context of the situation. People on the street ask me here in Australia, I'll say I'm from Sydney. If people overseas ask me where I'm from, I still say I'm from Sydney in Australia. And then, they might, if the conversation continues, I'll explain my background. And especially in Singapore, here's an interesting bit for you. In Singapore, I have a bit of a mixed identity because I'm going back to in my early years. So there's a lot of Singaporean in me, a lot of Malaysian in me. And I guess when I'm there, people think I'm from there. I can still speak all the colloquial and the bits and all the local languages and the Singlish and all that. So people will say, "Oh, you're from here, right?" I'm like, "Yeah, but I'm not." And it's there's a whole 30 odd years that's transpired in between then and now. And so it's quite bizarre. So in Asia, in Singapore, I'll say, "Yes, I'm from Australia, but I'm also from here." Then they go, "Ah, I understand what you mean. Yeah. I got it. I got it." And then, of course, depending on who it is, it actually then meanders into a local discussion, a full Singlish with the Hokkien and the Malay and the English and the everything that's just thrown in there. And anyone who's on the outside would go, "What are you saying?" And so, yeah, so it's extraordinary. So the last 7 months, 8 months of my life has been a bit of a real an awakening, a return to roots type thing. Quite extraordinary, actually. Yeah.
Would you like to sort of share a little bit more about how you intend to wrap up this career as a journalist? What is that end goal? Is it like an award, or is it like coming up as an independent publisher yourself? I don't know.
It's a very good question. I don't. I've been thinking about the last phase of my life. It sounds very macabre, but you think about how you want to end it all to finish it with a bang, perhaps. But journalistically, I think it'd be nice to do to go beyond print and do more multimedia, TV, sound, podcasts. And expand into the real digital world of journalism. Digital journalism has been such an intrusion into, journalism per se. But I think instead of just focusing on the surface shallow side of digital journalism, the clickbaits and the popular, the viral stuff, there's a lot of digital journalism that hasn't been really explored, like, using sound, for stories and vision for stories. So maybe I'd like to do more on that in the next few years of my life. How it ends, I actually really don't know, I'll be honest. Of late, it's been a bit of big unknown, especially with the turbulence of the last 3 years. I don't know how it will be and where I will be, actually, to be honest. I don't even know if it will be journalism forever. And that's a question I'm starting to ask myself now. I'm an accountant by training, and I've got a business background. Maybe I'll veer into something else. Or maybe I'll just, run an Airbnb quietly somewhere. And I recently met a couple in Indonesia, and they bought a beach resort with the intention of actually being an animal shelter. And then because friends started coming to live there, they started to expand build little villas on the beach. And suddenly now it's this cool semi-Mediterranean type resort. And that's their retirement plan. Maybe I'll do that. I don't know. Maybe somewhere.
Then you'll
Ooh.
be right in the middle of the South China Sea.
Oh yes, and maybe I will have one of those in the middle of on one of the islands in South China Sea. How ironic that would be, and that would be very interesting. Perhaps that'll be it. Perhaps it'll be something else. But it's occurred to me that an island lifestyle in Asia could well be a possibility, given my return to roots, and also that the fact that we have, you know, Asia or South China Sea Islands are amazing, beautiful. And so, yeah. So how, I don't really know how it all end up, but I'll keep going, and then I'll let you know, if you ask me if, in a few years, perhaps.
How that Sorry, goes. I didn't mean to make it sound
no,
so
it's okay.
Macabre, but
No. It's a really difficult question to answer, I feel. Okay. It just keeps changing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we've got 10 minutes left on this free, and I really wouldn't want to keep you any longer, Sulin. I really, really thank you for being so candid
open. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. I like to share more of my, I like sharing this part of my life as a Southeast Asian Australian, you know, openly, because I think when you do talk about it, people identify with it, whether that may be a convent school or, you know, an old style kampung house, or, you know, whether it's tiles under your feet, or whether that's, you know, one of your uncles is half British, or, you know, your aunt is from Portugal or wherever else. It's very, very interesting. And the food we eat, how we live our lives, you know, how parents fetch you to school and they take you back from school, the yellow buses, the public buses, the 50 cents, you know, the sweeties that you buy from the sundry shop. And I like to share all those things, because that is an insight into, for Australians, the migrant lives, migrants, you know, who come to Australia. But also, generally speaking, when you articulate these things, it brings back a certain memory that, you know, you can't really understand, because it's all in your head. But when someone says it out loud, it really brings a certain feeling to you. You know, when you talk Hokkien to each other, for example, it's quite funny, quite cool.
Was pretty cool.
Exactly. So I think that's really nice. Yeah.
So it's tradition to end the interview with a piece that you would read, so that we can record your voice reading it. It could be something you wrote, it could be something factual or something creative, but I understand you've got an AFR article you'd like to share.
Yeah, I picked that one because it was written after Lee Kuan Yew died, and we were doing, you know, several pieces to commemorate that very historical moment. And I wrote a little bit about my childhood as a young person, you know, crossing, you know, the causeway to go to school in Singapore. I'll just read three parts and keep it simple. I mean, it's not the end of the story, but it's the start of the story rather. And I'll give you a sense of what happened, you know, in those days, you know, when I was a little girl. So, yeah.
When you're ready.
Okay. The date was April 2nd, 2015. The title is, In Singapore, Education Was Valued Above Everything Else. It Still Is. Kilometers of orange-colored school buses queued to clear immigration into Singapore, crossing the causeway, the bridge linking Malaysia and the island state. In the pre-dawn hours, it was a daily sight. Drowsy children, this writer was one of them in the 1980s, would march across flower-lit halls with passports in their hands, waiting for officers to wave them from one country into another. All for one purpose, school. Buses would travel 3 to 4 hours, starting at about 4 a.m. to pick up students across Johor Bahru, the southernmost city of Malaysia, and take them to schools throughout Singapore, but mostly to Woodlands, the northernmost township of the Republic. For some kids, the travel alone was a round trip of 7 hours. That's really it. That's the first three bars.
Wow. You did that every day.
Yeah. Yeah, every day.
And so did Ronnie Chiang, I remember.
Did he really? Oh, yes, he was a JB boy. That's right. Yes, he did. Yes. Yes, he did. He was. It's funny, he's a JB boy, so he did that. And yeah, a lot of us did. It's a sea of children, sea of students. Extraordinary. It's quite a sight. And it's very dark because it's about 4 or 5 a.m., so it's very dark. And you can still hear the cockerels crowing just then at the time. And, you know, it's like, you know, the coo, 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 coo. And then maybe the mosque prayers might come on. And then the sound of the buses, and then suddenly, you know, you got, you know, the children chattering and then people talking on the bus. And then the auntie would go, sit down, you know, like, you know. And then all in Chinese, or 坐下来, 坐下来.
快点，快点，快点，快点，去去去去去，过那边啊，我等你那边啊，等你啊。Okay, so to say, you know, wait for you on the other side, and yeah, okay, 快点上上上上，走了走了走了，you know, and let's go. So,
And you just brought me to that moment, that Woodlands checkpoint.
the Woodlands Checkpoint, and most of them, of course, the aunties and uncles, the drivers, a lot of them speak Mandarin, and you know, and they were like, oh, 快点上车上车上车。不要等啦，那么多人，快点上车啦，我们走了。And then the kids will get off, and then they'll scoot off, and then all, you know, they'll drive across, and they'll drop them off to schools, and everybody will rush off, and then they'll start all over again. Sometimes, if you don't want to get on the bus from school, some of us will walk to the immigration and have a little ice kacang or a cheng tng or a snack at the Woodland Center Food Center. And then you're like, oh, and then the kids would then cross over and they wait on the other side for the bus to turn up. They'll time it so that they know their bus will be there at the time. They'll be like, oh, 你要上车啊？我刚才没有看到你在学校啊。哦，我去那个地方吃一点东西。And then the driver will get say, 哦，上上上，今天很多人，快点，挤挤挤。And then you have to share seats with each other. And then you'll drive across and they'll drop you off home again. And then it starts all over again the next day. Yeah, that's it.
What an effort
Crazy
for
fun.
school.
For school, yeah. And it's hot. Don't forget, it's bloody humid, as you know. So yeah, not an easy commute. And it starts at crack of dawn and it goes on all day. Sometimes if you have extracurricular activities, it goes on till 4 or 5 in the afternoon. You're not home till about 7 a.m. and 8 a.m. in the night. And you know, and then you start again at 4 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock in the morning.
That's
So yeah.
amazing. That's what brought the citizen of the world out of you.
Maybe perhaps. It's so generic, it's so local, it's so raw, it's so something you don't see in Australia. And I think,
It's
yeah,
as if Australia and New Zealand were connected by a bridge,
Rich.
and
Yeah.
people would
Pretty
cross
much.
that bridge to go to school every day.
Correct. And it's yeah, exactly. And you have to carry a passport. And obviously the conditions aren't like, you know, in Australia. It's a you know, at the time in the 80s, it was a developing, you know, Malaysia's super developing, and so is Singapore. And so, you know, roads are bumpy and holey, there are potholes everywhere, and buses are rudimentary. And you know, it's not, it's just pollution everywhere. It's not like, oh, it's walk in the park. No, it's not like that at all. It's a big hike, big hike, big travel.
So how do people follow you? Do you have a website or do you tweet?
Yeah, I have a Twitter account. I haven't tweeted very much in recent years. You definitely go there. That'd be a good one.
What
That's
is
always
it?
awesome. It's at Sulin_tan.
And it's spelt.
Sulin_tan.
So that's you on Twitter.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Jasmine Lowe's Audio Journey Experience, an AFT podcast production. Subscribe to the podcast on your preferred platform. And if you'd like to encourage us on, find out how you can support the production by visiting https listenbyheart.webprojects.com/podcast. WebProjects, WebProjects.com.